One small teacher story, but it's not that interesting. I did lose my head in it.
Okay.
Let's do
the first one then. Yeah. All right.
What was the other one again? If you've
lost. How long do you think you can survive without a head?
I haven't tried it, so I don't know.
Boom, boom. Roll the music.
Oh, yeah, forgot about that.
I'm always on the lookout.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge podcast. I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
And I'm Will. I'm a historian and I know nothing about geography.
So in this week's episode, Will and I will be going global. I will also tell Will why the World Cup was split in half and why Costa Rica will soon be the best economy in the world.
And I'm going to shrink some heads, blast out some brains, and then run around like a headless chicken.
Oh my God, okay.
Here we go.
Wow.
Should we get cracking?
I think we should get cracking.
Let's go straight into Misconception Corner then. And, hey kids, do you want to see a dead body?
Yes, please.
Tell me what you're looking at there, Reese.
Okay, so I am looking at first of all, I'm looking at a dead head on a plinth.
Dead head on a plinth.
Which is, it's called, in its mouth, it's got three ropes, mm-hmm. looks like coming down. And it's got, as I would describe, a grey old woman's hair. But you know when some women have really thick grey old hair? It's a bit like that. And I have to say, the mouth is... the lips are very sort of far apart, sort of like a really big frown.
Uh-huh.
But,
yeah,
and the eyes are closed and a big knobbly nose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, though. I just know it's a head.
Uh-huh. Of?
A witch?
A head of a witch is a good guess. What you're looking at is a shrunken head.
Is that shrunken?
That is a shrunken head, yes.
Oh, is it? It actually looks like you've taken this photograph yourself.
I've not taken this photograph myself. I do not own shrunken heads. Thank you very much.
But it is a shrunken head.
Of.
So it's not a witch.
It's not a witch.
Okay. A doll?
It's not a doll.
Was it alive at one point?
It was alive at one point.
Okay. And I'm assuming it wasn't alive on the plinth.
It was not alive on the plinth, no.
No. So in that case then...
Had a skull and a brain and the whole shebang.
The whole lot going on for it. Is it not like... It's not it's not even a child, is it? This is an adult of some description.
This is an adult.
Oh my goodness. Have you got anything else to help me here?
Are we talking male or female?
It looks like a female.
Okay. Looks like a female, despite the fact that it has quite a prominent beard and quite a prominent moustache.
Oh, it's the beard that I can't see in the stash. Oh, wow. The moustache is there and the beard is there. Mm-hmm. They're black. I didn't mention that. They're black. Mm-hmm. The more I look at it, the more I think it's going to kill me.
Shrunken head of an adult.
Male.
Species.
Human.
There's a misconception.
That's not a human being.
That's not a human being. No.
Are we talking like anthropology, whatever it is? Are we going
anthropology?
Yeah, that's my first time, didn't I?
Yeah, we are, because so shrunken heads is my misconception.
Okay,
And there is a theme today.
Is it all shrunken heads?
It's not all shrunken heads, but it is the kind of theme that if you're eating this over your cornflakes, or actually more specifically spaghetti, you might just want to pause and come back in about an hour's time.
I see. Okay.
Because this is a shrunken head, and my misconception is shrunken heads. 80% of all shrunken heads were not human beings. And this shrunken head that you're looking at is actually the shrunken head of a sloth.
That's a sloth?
That's a sloth.
That does not look like... Doesn't look a sloth. Hang on a minute. Mm-hmm. Well, now you've said sloth... I kind of can see it. Yeah. That's incredible.
Little
beady
nose. I mean, we'll put this picture out on all our feeds, but
yes, of course.
Little beady nose, kind of wide eyes and wide mouth, as you were saying before, looks like it's frowning.
Yeah.
Sloth's got a big mouth. Yeah, that's because the vast majority of shrunken heads that exist in museums or in private collections, they're sloths, or they are rubber, or they're made out of some kind of leather that have been molded to look like a human head. The actual human shrunken heads are very, very rare.
I see.
And the reason why is because there's barely any tribes that actually produce shrunken heads.
So, guys, shrunken heads, though, why?
Why is quite tricky to answer, because there are so few tribes that actually do it. It seems to be something to do with possessing the soul of a vanquished foe. That's the idea. The brain obviously contains the seat of your personality.
Yes.
And so if you remove someone's head and keep their head, then you keep some aspect of their personality. And so the idea behind shrinking the head is to make it easier to carry, so you can carry dozens of these shrunken heads, where maybe wear them on a necklace, because they're only about the size of your fist.
Oh, really?
And the process is they obviously remove the skull from the neck. So you take the whole head off.
Right.
And then you make a cut in behind the ears and use that to then pull the skin off the skull.
Ugh.
And then put a wooden ball of some kind inside the skin.
Right.
And then boil it. And you're boiling it in a mixture of water and some herbs that contain a lot of tannins.
So okay.
Very rich black tea would do, for example. What that does is it causes it to shrivel up like a bit of a raisin and shrink all the way down to the size of the ball that it's in. And so now you've got someone's head about the size of a fist.
Wow. And so this is, they're shrinking it for convenience, if anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. For convenience, there's no skull in it, so it's very, very lightweight. So you can just tie these up and string them from your belt.
So. I see. So people have this then to carry around a soul and a personality attached to them.
Yeah, that's the idea. But they would discard them. Normally, they'd discard them quite soon after. They would only keep them for a couple of weeks because it's gross.
And also, you don't want a multiple personality disorder.
You do not. No, turn into a hydra with 17 different personalities. No, absolutely not. But
how old is the one that you showed me? Do we know things like that?
This one's probably about 100 years old. And the vast majority of them are about 100 years old. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because they're dried out. They're completely desiccated. So you can keep them in museums for as long as you want. And some museums, for example, the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford has had shrunken heads for 100 years. But actually, the Pitt Rivers Museum is notable amongst other museums because they've just decided to get rid of them. In 2020, they said, we're no longer going to keep these because it's disgusting. And it's very offensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Rude. What it reminded me of, and I'm sure that you know something similar of this, is you talked about the skin being peeled off. Whereas in Iceland, they do something similar with...
necropants.
Yes, the necropants. And you wear it's a scrotum peeling or something like that. And then the idea is you make a little purse out of a scrotum and then it fills instantly with money. I've never tried it.
Well, we're off to Iceland in a couple of weeks, so I'll let you know.
Yeah, can you find out for me, please?
I can, but we're not actually necropants, of course. The necropants are, for those of you who don't know, is the flayed legs of a man that are covered in runes and symbols and spells. The trouble is they're kept in the Museum of Witchcraft and Sorcery in the West Fjords of Iceland, but the real ones aren't on display. They use fiberglass replicas on display.
That's disappointing.
Which is disappointing.
That's
so why would you go?
Yeah, it's like in China when we went into Shangzhou Caves. And in Shangzhou Caves, there's no caves in Shangzhou. So what did the Chinese do? Just make them out of polystyrene and it's a tourist attraction.
Fake caves.
Yeah.
That's like in Hohenschwangau where the King Ludwig decided to build fake caves just in the middle of his castle just because he wanted to live in caves.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a strange thing to do. But actually, these shrunken heads are kind of similar to that because... What's the idea there is you're recreating a fake experience that no one's ever really had. Well, the shrunken heads were they're made by three different tribes from the northwestern Amazon. So in the absolute middle of...
flipping nowhere.
Yeah, Brazil and Peru and that kind of region. So just under the Andes. But Westerners saw them and thought that they were the best thing ever. So Westerners started buying them up. And as soon as Westerners start buying anything up, that means supply goes through the roof.
Yep.
And so the locals realize... There simply aren't enough people for us to kill. And what's more, most of the tribes don't know how to make them. So let's just kill things that look a bit like human beings, like sloths, chimpanzees, not chimpanzees in the Amazon, sloths, but other monkeys, spider monkeys, I think, might work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, I mean, even in the Pitt Rivers Museum, one of the greatest anthropological museums in the world, the vast majority of them were fakes. They're not real shrunken heads.
Wow. It just seems to me like a really waste of resources and time and effort. If not only is it disgusting, you're going to chuck it away anyway.
Yeah.
But they exist.
That's most souvenirs. It's just tat.
It is pretty much. And can I tell you, have you heard of the best ever souvenir I've bought someone whilst traveling?
No, I haven't.
And this maybe is a quite good way to end your misconception corner talking about crap things, but I have a rule and I'm sure...
I didn't think it was that bad.
So again, we're in China and my job is to, every time I go to China is to buy a souvenir which can be of use to the person I give it to, which happened to be my best friend's mum.
Nice.
She always wants a souvenir of use, but it has to be the most ridiculous thing where it's hard to find a use for. So when I was in China, I was in a tit for tat shop, and I bought the smallest shopping cart that you can imagine with wheels that you could push around. It was probably about 3 inches tall and 5 inches long. And I asked her to find a use for it. A week later, I came back in her kitchen next to the chicken where all the eggs are held. There is the chickens with the eggs in, and next to the bum hole of the chicken is the trolley with an egg inside, and she wheels it to the pan.
And when she needs to get another egg, does she then wheel it back?
Of course she does.
Excellent. Well, that's a much less harmful souvenir than a sloth's shrunken head.
It is.
Yeah. So responsible souvenir buying there, Reese. Congratulations.
Thank you. So we're into Misconception Corner Geography.
Here we go.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
And the question is, what impact has the rise of populist nationalism had on globalization?
Okay.
It's quite heavy, that question.
That is quite heavy.
Do you understand the question?
Yes, I do. It's going to go one of two ways. Obviously, you would think the nationalism means shutting borders, isolationism, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yes.
But it could also be nationalism leads to we want to produce more than other countries. And so build everything locally in order to dominate the global market. And I feel like the latter is slightly more sensible, and therefore I'm going to go for the former. I think it's had a negative effect.
Well, you've walked straight into Misconception Corner. It has had. So people tend to think that. Well, let me just actually, but just to do this, I'm going to read some headlines from news from really good news companies and outlets. So the Guardian said in 2016, globalization as we know it is over, and Brexit is the biggest sign yet. That was a headline in The Guardian.
The Guardian said that?
Yes, The Guardian said that.
Okay.
And then in the Boston Globe in 2017...
That makes sense.
Trump won, globalization lost. Now what?
Right.
And then there's a book by Stephen King before... not the novelist as we know it, but...
And it's called The Shining. And it's got nothing to do with this, but it's a good book.
It is a good book. But
that was Book Corner with Breach.
We turned into a book review podcast. No, this Stephen King is the chief economist of HSBC.
Okay.
And he says he's written a book, and it's Grave New World, The End of Globalization, The Return of History.
Right.
So what we're talking about here is a big misconception that people think that because there's a lot of national uprising, lots of right-wing parties growing big in Europe and in USA, that it has a negative impact on globalization. But, and obviously the two indicators that we try to measure this by is by the Brexit vote in the UK, UK leaving the EU, and also the fact that Trump got into power with the Republican Party, tend to be kind of nationalist ideals that countries go by. So you would think as a result of this movement that globalization as a result is starting to decline. However, since the Brexit vote and Trump going into power in these time periods, globalization actually accelerated as a result. And the reason is all to do with how we measure globalization, because there are indicators of how we measure globalization. And the four ones that they are measured by are flows of trade, capital, information, and people.
Okay. Sounds like the four horsemen of the pockets to me.
It does actually, you're right. But according to the DHL Connections, a connectedness index does exist. these rows, the flows of trade, supply chains and so on and so forth, capital, so people owning things in other countries, information, so the internet and how people communicate with one another, and also the movement of people in 2017, all of which increased around the world,
right,
which is a sign that globalization is increasing around the world. And actually nationalism and the rise of it isn't having much of an impact on that whatsoever. And actually, to go by what you said in the latter of your answer, probably is some of the reason why that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So there are risks and threats to globalization. For example, there are tariff wars between China and USA. There's a big tariff war with the steel industry at the moment. Trump wants to put high amounts of imported tariff for steel to protect the American worker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so therefore they're going to build more steel factories in the USA, and therefore they employ more Americans. And that is a threat to globalization because therefore you're not using Chinese steel, for example. There's also, there are crackdowns of immigration. The US and the Mexican border is a great example of that, huge crackdowns, but it's also happening globally as well. Australia, for example, have very strict irrigation laws, they might do, but also immigration laws as well. But trade continues to grow globally. People are still moving and soft power continues to be distributed globally through the internet. So it's had some impact. National uprising of right wing and protectionism, but actually it hasn't reversed globalization whatsoever. There's no trend to show that it actually is reversing. If anything, it's probably of recent slightly slowed it down.
Right,
but there's no actual reversing of globalization due to nationalist policies and nationalists rising around the world.
And I wonder if with Russia's actions recently,
yes,
we'll see even more globalization in the future. I mean, Sweden and Finland, as of today, Finland has certainly applied to join NATO. Mm-hmm. I know that's not economic globalization, but it is countries working together in which is globalization.
Essentially what that is.
Globalization.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I do wonder if looking at Russia's inability to actually do what they wanted to do in any remotely successful way, and been hideous for everyone involved, that it's the end of that period of history. To an extent, unless they're going to double down. Who knows?
That's frightening to think about.
Spicy living in the end times, isn't it?
It is spicy at the moment. It is. Anything is possible.
It is.
So much like Ukraine winning Eurovision.
Well, I had a thought when I was watching Eurovision yesterday, because as you well know, it's been probably a decade since I last watched Eurovision, but you're a massive Eurovision fan.
I am a Eurovision fan. I love Eurovision. I like the songs. I think it's entertaining. But as I've said before, to you personally, not on the podcast, but like I really enjoy the live TV element of it because literally anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And you're watching presenters who aren't really designed to be presenters. That's not their career.
Yeah.
And that to me is entertaining enough on top of absolutely ridiculous entries of songs, which for me are just glorious to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you watched it all the way through every single minute.
I did, yeah. But I overthink things, as you well know. And and I had a realization that actually this isn't just stupid fun. This is actually the most important thing we could possibly be doing at this point in history, which sounds insane because
it does.
Like what? Dressing up as a wolf slash banana hybrid is the most important thing. No, but the thing is, how do you stop Europe going to war? Is a question that has never been solved in human history. Europe has always gone to war with itself, except the majority of Europe since 1945. And the reason why is because they realized in 1945, if we try and separate off each country from each other, then of course we're going to keep on going to war. We need to intertwine each country as much as possible with other countries so that it is impossible to go to war. Because there is no way that I could support, for example, the United Kingdom going to war with Germany because we live in Germany. And I couldn't support Germany going to war with Slovakia because my wife's from Slovakia. And I couldn't support, say, Spain going to war with France because I thought the French entry last night kicked ass. And the Spain entry last night was full of ass.
Exactly.
So it's building up those layers of interconnection based on extraordinarily cheesy music.
Incredibly cheesy music.
But now, don't you just care more for Moldova?
I do.
Than you did the day before?
That's the most I know about Moldova, really.
Exactly.
Is that song.
And someone today said it works. I'd never heard of Moldova until they played in the Champions League this season. But that's the whole point. It's exactly the same thing. I don't want to go to war with Romania because we beat CFR Cluj a couple of years ago. And I'd be quite happy to face them again in the Champions League.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's how it works.
And interestingly, you said that after 1945, we should not go at war. The Eurovision, I think, started in 1957.
Exactly. Yeah. It is all the post-war, how do we solve this problem? And after the First World War, they got it so badly wrong. But after the Second World War, they seem to have got it right. Okay, so my main article this week is called Fair is Foul and Foul is Fair. And my question for you is, how long do you think you can survive without your head?
How long do I think I can survive without my head?
Yeah, how long do you think consciousness would last in your noggin?
So when my head is disconnected from my body in that sense, instantly, yeah. I'm imagining being guillotined here.
That will do.
That will do it. If I'm Louis the 16th, have another go at it. And then my head will detach from my body. It's one of those things. I imagine that you would lose consciousness instantly because I know that people lose conscience instantly with lesser things being done to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like being shot, for example, and then you're sick.
Yeah.
So I would assume having your arteries severed in your neck and your spine ripped apart
would do it instantly. I think
would insta-death almost.
Yeah. And that seems to be the case with most guillotine victims. Maybe the eyes will move a little bit. Maybe the tongue will spasm a little bit, but that's normally just electrical signals. That's nothing. That's like when you, chop a snake in half, as we've all done, and the back will start wiggling. It's just electrical signals being left over in the nerves. Instantaneous would seem to be about right. Well, let me tell you about someone who survived for 18 months without their head.
Okay.
Someone is maybe stretching it.
Many questions that you haven't even started. Hope you answer them.
Fair is foul, foul is fair. So a farmer in Colorado called Lloyd Olson loved to please his wife, Clara. And that meant when Clara's mother was over, killing a chicken and having a roast chicken dinner and giving mother-in-law Olson the chicken neck. She loves chicken necks. And so on September the 10th, 1945, Clara Olson gets her mother over. It's chicken supper. So Lloyd heads out to the coops on his Colorado farm and he picks up a 5.5-month-old male called Mike. And he holds Mike down against the tree stump and he gets his axe out. And the axe falls, taking off Mike's head with one single swoop. And the head falls onto the floor and there's a little bit of blood left on the axe. And Lloyd goes to pick up Mike's carcass in order to go and feather it and take it in. When all of a sudden, Mike, the headless chicken, stands up and starts trying to preen his feathers.
Ah!
What Lloyd had managed to do was decapitate Mike, but he'd missed one ear, and he'd missed most of the brain stem, and he'd missed the jugular vein. So he'd taken off the brain, and he'd taken off the eyes and the beak and the tongue and everything like that. But the part of the spinal cord that connects the brain to the rest of the body was mostly intact. So not only did Mike have a functioning nervous system, but he also had sufficient blood flow into that nervous system to keep him alive. So Mike starts stumbling about a little bit, but he starts bobbing his headless neck down towards the ground as if he's trying to peck for food. And he also starts crowing, as chickens will do. But the thing is, because he's missing a beak and he's missing a vocal tract, he just starts gurgling instead. So Olson presumed this is a weird form of nervous spasms, which often happens after you decapitate someone or something. And it would subside after a minute or two. So he picks up another chicken, decapitates it. This one survives fine. And they go in and have their chicken supper. And Mike comes back the next morning, having forgotten all about Mike. And he finds Mike curled up in a ball, sleeping with his headless head tucked underneath his wing.
What the?
So with his neck kind of tucked underneath as if he had a head still. So, what?
there's a natural pause here.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things. Yeah. When you first said, how long can you live out a head? I initially thought the head bit rather than the body bit. Uh-huh. That was my first bit.
Yeah, the head bit's screwed.
Head bit's done in.
Because you need blood going to the brain for the brain to function.
Yeah. So this so far is a chicken with just body and hole in head, neck.
Yeah.
That gurgles when it wants to wake you up in the morning.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
It went to taking sustenance and food off the floor.
But it couldn't.
It couldn't.
Because it doesn't have a head.
The thing is, though, now what I'm starting to think of here is that if it's lived for that long, someone's taken a keen interest because it can't feed itself.
Someone has taken a keen interest. You're exactly right. Because, this is the 1940s and farmers in the 1940s are not exactly going to make a barrel load of money off chickens. So,
I can see where this may be going.
Well, Olson had exactly the same idea because he realized this is my ticket out of here. He needs to keep Mike alive because freak shows.
Yeah,
of course. Put Mike in the freak show.
And the people are going to love it.
People will flip and love it. Yeah. So what Lloyd Olson does is he spends a couple of days and weeks figuring out how am I going to keep this chicken alive? I can't just put food down its throat because it will choke. So instead, what he comes up with is pipettes and syringes.
Uh-huh.
And he will put the syringe down Mike's throat and empty it of milk, and the milk will go down into Mike's stomach, and he will crush up corn, and he will chop up worms, and he will pipette them down Mike's throat as well. So Mike doesn't have to do any chewing, but he can still do all the digesting.
Ah, there's a lot. So basically, Lloyd's being the teeth.
Yes. Lloyd is Mike's teeth. Yeah. So Lloyd has a whole set in of feeding pipettes and cleaning syringes. And the idea behind the cleaning is as well, because it's an exposed throat, infection's very easy to get.
Yeah.
So he needs to keep it clean, needs to keep it open, needs to keep the windpipe clean as well. And so it wasn't particularly uncommon for a piece of corn or a piece of worm to get stuck or to get lodged in Mike's throat. So Lloyd always, always, always kept the syringes with him when he had Mike with him.
Always be wielding your syringes.
Exactly. Wherever Mike goes, the syringe follows.
Yes.
Otherwise, we're in trouble.
Good rule of thumb.
It is. You have headless chicken, bring your syringes. So, of course, it didn't take long for people to find out about Mike the Headless Chicken, because it's a headless chicken.
Yeah, that, well, yeah.
And it walks around and it kind of stumbles a little bit because he doesn't have a fantastic balance.
Or brain.
Or no brain. Walking into the walls and that kind of thing. But Lloyd manages to get some agents involved. And agents contact sideshows. And those sideshows get him into circuses and funfairs that start touring the length and breadth of the USA. And so the idea there is that outside of a town in a dark field, after work, thousands of people would come from all over the county to see crazy acts like the incredible fat lady, who is a real person. She's just fat.
Incredibly just fat.
Very fat.
Just very fat lady.
Just a very fat lady. Dancing dwarves, conjoined twins, babies with two heads, fire breathers, sword eaters. And there, in between the bearded ladies and the contortionists, was the headline act, Mike the Headless Chicken. And
the 1940s are mental.
The thing is, they have some TV then. They don't even have that excuse. They have electric instruments. I guess they don't quite have electric guitars yet.
Okay.
But they have things to do. Have you ever been to a freak show or a sideshow?
No, I haven't actually.
I have, and it was the most distressing thing I've ever been to.
I can only imagine it is.
It was horrific, because they had not just tattooed men, but men with those, you know, silicon implants that kind of,
yes,
turn you into, like, you kind of put horns in your head and things like that.
Yep.
One of them.
Ugh.
A contortionist who, as far as I could tell, didn't have limbs made out of bones, had limbs made out of, like, Stretched Armstrong, exactly. And the farting man, who did exactly what you can say. He had, you know how you can make yourself belch by swallowing air?
Yes. Did he do the opposite for his...
He did it rectally.
Oh!
Which, in hindsight, was anthropologically incredible.
That's amazing, because you can also say he's an anal sucker.
He is absolutely an anal sucker. Thank you for that mental image.
You're welcome.
For some reason, now you say sucker, is that why Henry has got the look on his face? But yeah, I had to leave. Like, my family were flipping loving it, and I just couldn't stand it. It was too surreal, I suppose, for me. It was just overwhelming.
Overstimulating.
Yeah, see this man suck up air into his anus and expel it in tune to, like, the Marseillaise or something.
Oh, really?
He had some skill with his with his anus. Yeah, it was quite remarkable.
That's a talent.
It is. Unfortunately.
Yes, it is. I just imagine these places, though, as fun as they could be for some people, also seem like quite a depressing environment. Like,
that's what I found. I found it exploitative and depressing.
Yeah, and that's not nice.
Is this the mark you're leaving on the earth?
That's your legacy.
A literal shit stain. So, but for Olsen, I mean, like, take advantage of it. He doesn't have anything to lose. And it's not like Mike knows what's going on.
No, he doesn't
have a brain.
He doesn't have anything going on apart from legs.
So it would cost you 25 cents in 1945 to see Mike the Headless Chicken, which is about €3 today. So
okay.
That's not that bad.
It's not that bad. It's not expensive. So if the demand is high.
That's the thing. And I mean, you can see headless chickens for free in the butcher shop, but they're not alive.
Yeah, that's a big difference, isn't it?
So €3, yeah, why not? And he would strut up and down the cage, and he would peck about on the ground for food, and he would crow at the audience, all without a head. And people loved it, because throughout 1946, Lloyd Olsen was making somewhere around $4,500 a month. So that's about 60,000 euros a month.
Wow.
From these shows. So, I mean, throughout a year, we're talking 700,000 euros. That's a huge amount of money for a dirt poor farmer.
But that's a lot. That's a lot of money for someone who doesn't know how to cut a chicken's head off.
Yeah, someone who's actually on the, when we make an accounting of everything, is actually just a little bit shit at his job.
Yes, essentially.
Yeah. So Mike ends up being valued and insured for $10,000, which is about 140,000 euros.
Okay.
That's not bad.
No.
For a headless chicken. And life is good for Lloyd. Life is technically good for Mike because he's still alive, but not that he knows anything about it. Lloyd's having a great time touring up and down the country. Clara's coming with him. And we're only 15 years removed from the Great Depression and from the Dust Bowl, which just decimated the US.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, we have a golden ticket for this one farmer. And they really took advantage of it. And by the time we get to the winter of 1946 into January, February of 1947, they're touring constantly, enjoying life out on the road. And by the time we get to March of 1947, they are in Phoenix, Arizona, which is quite a long way from Colorado, but they've been everywhere over the country. And in Phoenix, the tour is going to stay there for a couple of nights. So the Olsons book a motel. And they commute over to the circus. It's only a couple of miles. And they keep the syringes with them at all times.
Of course.
Because they have to clean Mike constantly. And so their nightly routine is get back to the motel, pop on the TV, hop in bed and have a drink, feed Mike, give him a kiss on his non-existent forehead, and then pop him in bed. And trouble is, one night, Mike has a piece of corn go down the wrong way.
Oh.
And this is a common occurrence. This is fine. Not a big deal. So Lloyd goes to get the syringes. And the syringes aren't where he thought they were. So he starts looking around the motel room. And Mike at this point is, I mean, he's got a piece of corn stuck in his throat. So he is gurgling.
He's
and
gurgling
gasping.
And choking here.
Yeah. And the syringes aren't anywhere in the hotel room. So he sends Clara out to the car. And Clara can't find them in the car. And by this time, about 90 seconds have passed. And time is more or less up. And the Olsons are scrabbling around looking for anything they can. They can't fish it out with a finger because his throat's just simply too small and there's nothing they can do. And unfortunately, poor Mike the Headless Chicken doesn't die from being beheaded. He simply dies because there was a piece of corn stuck in his windpipe and you just can't fish out a tiny piece of corn from a tiny chicken windpipe without syringes. So poor Mike lasted 18 months.
So that's a good life. That's good for a headless chicken, though, isn't it?
It is. You know, they don't normally last more than a couple of seconds, so he's done very well there.
That's an anomaly.
Yeah.
As headless chickens go.
Yeah, that's like what's the average number of arms on Earth? It's about 1.8 per person. Yeah, Mike's really brought the average up there to the lifespan of a headless chicken.
And the thing, with that fact, I'm sure there's someone with three arms that are trying their best to bring it up.
So, Mike, he was from a town called Fruita, is it Fruita or Fruita? Do you know what? I didn't bother to look it up because there's only about 5,000 people and we don't have any Coloradan listeners at this point, so I can insult them all they want. With your big square state, what are you?
Yes, well, it is just
South Wyoming, grow up.
Making friends?
So his hometown, Fruita, Colorado, he's an icon because of course he is, because he's a headless chicken.
Yeah.
And they have an annual Mike the Headless Chicken Day, which is coming up on, I think it's about June the 10th.
Oh, that's very soon.
So you can make it over there if you want. And you have the 5K run like a headless chicken race, which is good.
Excellent.
Egg toss, of course.
Yeah, well, it has to be egg toss.
My personal favorite, which is chicken bingo.
How does that work?
Do you want to have a guess?
Is it Mike calls out numbers?
Mike doesn't. Two. No. What they do is they get a numbered grid on the floor and then they just let chickens shit all over it. And wherever the poo lands, that's your number.
That's the number.
Yeah. Mike survived for almost 2 years because his brain stem contained just enough brain to maintain his breathing, to maintain his heart rate and his reflex actions, which for chickens aren't really stored in the brain. They're stored in the spinal cord.
Ah, okay.
And the weirdest thing is the way that he could walk is because chickens' balance and motor functions are not kept in their brain. They're kept in their hips. They have glands in their hips.
Oh, wow.
A separate nervous system that's completely separate from their flying system. that's down in their hips.
Not famous flyers, mind you.
No, they're not. No, because they've got tiny little brains, because they don't need their brains.
No, yeah, not.
So the answer to the question, how long can you survive without a head? Well, if you're a chicken, forever.
Yeah.
As long as you don't choke.
Yeah, as long as you don't choke. We've had a lot of chickens in our podcast today.
Have we?
Yeah, we had the egg and the chicken and the trolley.
Oh, yeah, of course we did. Yeah.
Which is a shit version of the Lion Witch and the Wardrobe. So, it's my turn. And I've called my one, The Story of the Worst Football Team and Their Vulcanism.
The story of the worst football team and their what?
Vulcanism.
Vulcanism.
Yeah, like volcanicity, but I wanted to sort of change the word ending slightly.
Okay.
I thought it'd be quite fun to do.
I have no idea where you're going with this.
So our journey starts in Japan. It's 30th of June, 2002, and we are in the Yokohama International Stadium. Brazil are playing Germany for the Grand Prize of global football, and it's the Jules Rimet, which is known as...
the World Cup final.
Yeah, so the World Cup final.
Mm. But the... I'm just going to issue a slight correction so we don't get any letters from anoraks. The Jules Rimet trophy was the old World Cup.
Aha. Uh-huh.
The modern one came in the 1980s, I think, about 1982, 1983, because the Jules Rimet trophy went missing and we don't know where it is. So the modern one is called... I think it's just got a boring name, like the FIFA World Cup trophy.
That's a terrible name.
Which
really
is a terrible name.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what they're playing for.
That's what they're playing for. They're playing for the boring name of the World Cup trophy. The gold one that everyone of our generation will recognize as the World Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so do you know the score of that game by any chance?
I'm trying to rack my brain. I know that we're talking Rivaldo, Ronaldinho, Ronaldo.
It's that team.
I remember Michael Owen scoring that goal in the quarterfinal and then Ronaldinho pinging one over David Steeman and my little 11-year-old heartbreaking.
Yes.
But I cannot remember the game against Germany.
No, because we were probably, after England got knocked out, that was kind
probably
of
still
it,
in
really.
Tears.
But Ronaldo was the only man to score in this game, as Brazil lifted the World Cup in front of 70,000 people. There's a lot of people there, obviously. After a 2-0 victory for Brazil.
2-0.
And going into the football history books.
Right.
Okay. But yeah, I started this as the worst football team in their Vulcanism.
Which that Brazilian team were not the worst football team in the
world. No, actually, because they won the World Cup.
They were one of the best ever.
So, what is a question for you. What would you say if I was tell you that there was another official international football match on that day?
I would say that is bad planning.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Is that a FIFA-sanctioned game? Because they have really missed the boat there.
One of them, I'll even tell you that it was FIFA-ranked.
Are we sure we're not missing anything? We're scheduling it on June 20th.
30th. Yeah. So, that is, were you the planning committee? So. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, Will, I'm going to show you a video, okay?
Okay.
And what I want you to do is when I show you this video, I want you to describe what you see.
Okay. Okay, so I have the vid here and should I read the title out to people?
No, just watch the video.
I shan't. Okay, so we've got a corner kick is just being taken in front of what looks like a pagoda of some kind. A very scrappy goal has just been scored behind a goalie who appears to not know how to use his arms. And he's looking both disappointed and old, which is fair. We've got another corner kick coming in from the other side, do we? Oh no, this is a free kick, and the wall is about a metre in front of the goalie, which seems bad. And, he doesn't know how to use his arms, and he is old. Number 9 for the yellow team has a very nice do-rag on for some reason. And, that is not defending. That this goalie is... Oh, there's a dog on the pitch! We got a dog on the pitch! Hey! And one team, I would guess the African team, are holding up a trophy that's just been split in half and is solid. And I think that I've just had a very bad fever dream because, wow.
So, Will, what did you make of that video that you just watched?
So, we occasionally have a little kick around after work on a Friday. And
yes.
Our goalkeeping skills are better than that because that... You know the look of, it's the goalkeeper had the stance the entire time of a man who's just run for the bus and has just missed the bus and never really wanted to get the bus and is just kind of, I'm fed up with everything in my life.
Yeah.
So he's let his side down there. Dog on the pitch was excellent.
Always dog on the pitch is excellent.
We love that.
Yeah.
Second only really to dog in the playground.
Yes.
Which is
also excellent.
A pure slice of anarchic beauty. We love that. But why did the trophy split in half?
Well, would you like to know the story of this game?
I think I need to know what's going on because this is on the same day as the World Cup final.
This game happened on the same day as the World Cup final.
Right.
So we're going to chuck in another layer here before we get going. So the Netherlands
okay.
did not qualify for the World Cup in Japan in South Korea in 2002. So how did the Dutch occupy their time during their national football blackout? Would you say?
Did they organise a second competition and they called it like the FIFA World Cup bracket cool kids only?
I think when I describe what happens here, you'll understand why it will be clear to see that the Netherlands has a very, no law against marijuana whatsoever.
Right.
There's two people. We've got Johan Kramer and Matthias de Jong. And they're filmmakers for the Kessels Kramer Film Agency. Mm-hmm. They decide to go on an unusual journey to have the worst two international football teams fight it out on the field the same day as the World Cup final.
That's what's going on here, I see.
So Kramer said that he thought a documentary about losing could track some interest. Of course it can. but the two teams in question could not be further apart both culturally and geographically. And the fixture, which is what you've seen in this video, is between Bhutan and Montserrat.
Right.
So the lowest ranked football teams in FIFA in 2002.
Now that's interesting because surely... Oh, I guess the Vatican aren't in FIFA. That's how that works. Right.
That's pretty much it. So Kramer had this idea, and what he did, he wanted to make this game happen, and he contacted both footballing bodies from these two countries. He sent a fax. and Montserrat responded the same day with great enthusiasm, whereas Bhutan took 3 weeks to respond, using obviously their Buddhist wise thinking to eventually agree. So they both agreed with the fixture should take place. But I'm going to stop the story of the football match right there,
mm-hmm.
because it's important before we can see exactly how this football match unfolds, we need to look at the current state of Montserrat at this moment in time.
Okay, so in 2002.
So 2002. Okay, so Bhutan are the second worst footballing nation. Montserrat are the worst. Do you know where Montserrat is?
It's either in the Caribbean or the Indian Ocean. I think it's in the Caribbean.
It's in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's part of the Caribbean island chain. Mm-hmm. One of the islands there. And it is home to Chances Peak Volcano, and it's part of the Sufria Hills volcanoes on the island. So there's a few volcanoes there.
Okay.
Plymouth is the capital, and it is situated southwest at the foot of Chances Peak, and that is obviously the big volcano. Montserrat has a population of about 12,000 people, and it's just like you would imagine kind of this Caribbean relaxed idyllic lifestyle which they have. The national language is English. They speak English there. It is an old a British overseas territory as well. I think it's even still is today and has strong ties with the UK. That's actually really important to this story.
Right.
Is to bear that in mind. The British Overseas Territory has not experienced any rumblings from any volcano since the 16th century.
Right.
But this all changed in July of 1995, and the volcano of Chances Peak erupted.
Okay, and was it a big one?
Well, this is the thing. Okay, firstly, what you need to remember here is that if the last eruption was in the 16th century... Not only do the people living there at the moment never experience a volcanic eruption, their mothers and fathers haven't, their grandparents haven't, and their great-grandparents haven't, and probably their great-great-great-grandparents have never experienced a volcanic eruption. Usually in places that have frequent hazards like earthquakes, volcanoes, and tsunamis, you either have experienced one or you've read of stories or heard it from Daniel family of what to do when a volcano erupts. These guys have had none of that. So it's a complete shock to them. Very similar to the Haiti earthquake of 2010. They hadn't had one for about 120 years of that magnitude. Again, the people don't really know how to react in this time. But let me just kind of describe this. So the island has become increasingly seismic over the last 50 years since 1995. And eventually the eruption was not, and it's important, was not a one-off explosion. It erupted continuously until 1997.
Whoa.
It just kept going.
2 years of eruption.
Pretty much. But it wasn't like a, it wasn't like just boom, like you would see in Hawaii, which is constantly erupting yeah. over time. Like just keeps doing it. This was like a big eruption. It would lie low for about a week or two or a month and then go bang, it would go again.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't like a continual flow.
No.
It was like a very slow machine gun.
Pretty much. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it keeps erupting and erupting. But over this time, the capital Plymouth was completely evacuated and abandoned because it sat at the southwest foot of Chance's Peak. It was completely obliterated, the capital. 19 people were killed over this time period of Montserrat.
That's not very many.
It's not very many.
Considering 2 years.
Of 2 years. However, 19 people for a volcanic eruption actually is a bit more significant than you think.
Is it?
Yeah, it's quite a localized event. Right. You imagine an earthquake is over a larger aerial extent,
whereas
a volcano is usually quite localized. A bit like the difference between a hurricane and tornado, I suppose, as we discussed before. Very similar in that sense. So, yeah, 90 people isn't a lot in the grand scheme of things of all hazards. But actually, for a volcano, it's significant enough to be noteworthy, if you know what I mean.
That's it. So something like Pompeii is, like, unheard of.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's a one-off.
Yeah, so something of that magnitude is insane. Yeah, of course. But yeah, 90 people, you know, there are obviously other eruptions that have killed thousands of people before. But, you know, 19 people were not of a country that just has 12,000 people for a volcano actually is relatively significant. When this erupted, over the 2 years, 5,000 people fled the island to seek permanent residency elsewhere because their whole home is being obliterated. This is affecting the whole island. And we're having people resettling at other Caribbean islands, but actually the majority resettle permanently in the United Kingdom because of the link that they have there.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. I think the British said, yeah, come over here, you can set up, we'll help you. That, again, is also really important to the of this story. So bear that one in mind as well. The unemployment rate over the 2 years was, to begin with, 7%. It rose to 50%.
Fair.
Which is a half the country.
If they don't have a capital, that is reasonable.
Yeah, right. and the island pretty much became, the whole island, apart from areas in the north, became uninhabitable. They actually had exclusion zones. So in the south, you could not go there whatsoever. There was a middle band where only scientists or people of special interest to support the Montserratian people could go. And then there was an area north of Montserrat. I think St. John's is a town up there. Literally, it was that and a couple of other smatterings of towns you could stay in, which were habitable. But yeah, pretty much the whole island was screwed. Some people refused to move away from their home and their native land. There's a song, actually. I'm going to have to play it to you. And it's called "Ah, Just Can't Run Away" by The Arrows, which is a local Montserrat artist who clearly describes this feeling. And I am going to play you a bit of that, actually.
And his feeling was, just can't run away.
And I'm going to play you this song.
Be fair, if you're being blown up at by a volcano,
yeah,
that is entirely reasonable.
Okay, so I'm going to play the world of song. It's called Just Can't Run Away, and it's by Arrow.
The Caribbean, man, they like, as long as there's grapefruit and mangoes, I'll be holding on. The island is on fire.
Pretty much, yeah.
For 2 years, anything on fire for 2 years is a massive problem. But an island on fire for 2 years, nah, whatever, I'm not going to go away, there's mangoes here.
Exactly. Why would you leave?
I do love mangoes.
Exactly right. And if they're not on fire, if you can find a place...
cool
What's
mango.
What's the point of leaving?
What's the point?
Yeah, so you kind of get the vibe of the island.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, so, but one of the consequences of the eruption is that Montserrat has put football as a result at its lowest priority, and thus they are the lowest ranked FIFA international team, with Bhutan being second worst. So you get the context of Montserrat of why they are the worst international team in the world in 2002 still.
Makes sense.
It makes total sense. So back to 2002, the journey to Bhutan was something of a feat itself, okay? So obviously because of a volcano erupting, we're not going to hold it in Montserrat.
It's an away game. That's fair.
Yeah, right. We're going to put it in Bhutan.
That's reasonable.
Okay. So Montserrat had to the team had to travel Montserrat to Antigua, Antigua to St. Martin, St. Martin to Krakow.
Hang on,
Krakow.
Wait. Those first three stops are completely unnecessary, but so purely Caribbean.
Absolutely right.
Should we go to Antigua? Sure. Do we need to? Well, they got mango and grapefruit, so I guess we do need
Let's
to.
Let's go. So they made it to Krakow.
Yeah, which is a disappointment after St. Martin's.
It is. Sure. But they then do go Krakow to Amsterdam.
Okay, back in business.
Right. But Amsterdam to Bangkok.
Right.
Bangkok to Calcutta.
This is...
And Calcutta to Thimphu, okay, which is the capital of Bhutan.
And how many of them actually survived what must have been the world's greatest pub crawl?
Well, they made it... Well, you saw the football match.
That's why it doesn't have arms anymore.
So that was Montserrat's journey to Bhutan.
Uh-huh.
Quite extraordinary. So the game... is being held in the Bhutanese mountainside. I hope it is Bhutanese, because you could say beautiful then.
Ah. Oh.
That's quite cool, no?
That, yeah. That's fair.
So it's in the Bhutanese mountainside, which is to their advantage, actually, because they're used to the altitude of being, was it 50 or however many thousand feet above sea level.
That's a bit unfair.
Yeah, so they've got a little bit of advantage there. But this game was held in front of 15,000 people in the Chang Limitang Stadium, which is a quite cool name. To me, really?
Yeah.
Chang Limitang Stadium.
Chang Limitang.
It's quite cool.
That's excellent.
That rolls off the tongue. Took me a while to learn how to read that and say it as well.
Chang Limitang.
Yeah. Even better, English Premier League referee Steve Bennett is in charge.
Great.
Bhutan declares a public holiday.
Nice.
A public postage stamp has been made.
Beautiful.
And for the event, FIFA decide that the end result to count towards the official rankings.
Fantastic.
What's not to like? The scene
is
set.
Not to like?
Scene is set for a really exciting game.
Yeah.
So, do you want to hear about the game?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Captain Wange Dorji scored the first goal.
Go on, say it again.
Wange Dorji. That's a good name.
We're such children.
We're
sometimes.
Awful, aren't we? So Captain Wange Dorji scored the first goal of the game for the host just after 4 minutes. So the first goal you saw there just after four
minutes. It
wasn't
a very good one.
Oh, it was terrible. Right from recall. Yeah. I went through the goalkeeper's whatever.
Inept arms.
Yeah, in the back of the net. So this was a score come half time. And Kramer says half the population of Thimphu went to the game. So the half of the city are there. And he said, and what happened in the second half was quite incredible. Okay, so the Bhutan started to feel guilty about their team winning.
Oh.
And with their Buddhist mentality, a draw obviously would be the best result for them. So they started to cheer for Montserrat.
Lovely. The Bhutanese.
Right.
Lovely.
It must be great. Do you know in Bhutan they were the last country to have TV?
Were they?
Yeah, 1999, I think. Uh-huh. And also one of the only countries to ban smoking.
I didn't know they banned smoking.
Yeah, the Bhutan's a weird and wonderful
place. I knew that they. I don't know if it originated there or if they're the first country to make it the most important thing. Isn't gross domestic product? It's gross domestic happiness.
Yes, I'm aware.
So lovely.
It's a great place,
and they've got such fantastic forests there because they just simply refuse to sell them to logging companies.
Exactly.
And the companies turn up and say, "You could be really rich," and they say, "Why would we want to be rich? We're happy."
Yeah, exactly. What a great attitude to have.
The Bhutanese, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely.
But they don't have mangoes.
They haven't got mangoes.
So
back to Montserrat. So with them feeling guilty, they started to cheer on Montserrat. However, this was to no avail as Dorji, our friend Wange Dorji, ended up getting a hat trick. And Bhutan ended up being 4-0 winners at the end of the game. So as a result of that, Montserrat are sealed to the worst international football team in the world in 2002. So, but at the end of the match, in a moment that captured the spirit and the camaraderie of the game, Butana and Montserrat gathered around to sing a song taught by the Montserrat team. It was Hot, Hot, Hot by the Arrow, we just listened to. They cut the cup in half.
Right, that's what it was.
And held it up high into the air for all to cheer and see.
That's so lovely.
It is cool, isn't it? So you cut the cup in half. We can both share this. Both footballing bodies of Montserrat and Butan were there holding the cup. Kramer still holds this event as one of the best days in his life and dreams a final this year between, and 2022, San Marino and Anguilla.
Okay.
So it can, you know, he wants that to happen for the Qatar World Cup, but the two worst teams in the whole of the world.
I don't see why FIFA didn't pick it up and run with it.
Such a good idea.
I guess then that would be rugby, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's, that's a very good joke.
Thank you. But I mean, wouldn't that be awesome? The game before the World Cup final, like just have it in the stadium.
Yeah, of course.
Instead of that faffing about with the kind of closing ceremony, which nobody cares about. Oh, there's some opera and chucking around some big beach balls and stuff. No, have San Marino play against Anguilla.
Yeah, of course.
Excellent. Everyone would love it.
Absolutely. And that will sell out.
Dog on the pitch. Why not?
Yeah, we'll put a dog on the pitch. Yeah. Do you want to know what the name of this this game was called?
Yeah.
It was called The Other Final.
The Other Final. Which is nice.
And it is actually a documentary. The filmmaker genuinely made a documentary. You can find it on YouTube. I'll link it. It's about an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's excellent. And he actually follows the Montserrat team going to each of those places pretty much.
Which I bet is the only record of it, because there's no way anyone remembers those stopovers.
No, of course, Krakow, right?
And Amsterdam and Bangkok. Oh my God.
Would you like to have a bit more of a, there's a bit more of a success story with modern Montserrat.
Okay.
So they have improved. Right. So you could end the story here. But there is obviously this extra thing about Montserrat. So an uprising of Montserrat football occurred that could be attributed to the eruption of 1995, bizarrely.
Okay.
Which triggered the beginning of the worst football team. So you could say the eruption caused the worst football team in history.
Yeah.
But that would make sense.
That makes sense.
But it could also be the reason why they could have a better football team now. And this is why.
Can I hazard a guess?
Go on.
Is it because when volcanoes erupt, they leave very fertile soil? And that fertile soil means that they can grow more food, and now they got stronger babies, and now 20 years later they're making good football.
It would be a suitable leap to make, because your knowledge of fertile soil and volcanoes is very accurate.
Thank you.
But this isn't the case, unfortunately. So remember when I said 5,000 people left the island to go to the UK? This meant, as a result, there have been many new Montserratian generations born in the UK.
Right.
Okay. And as a result, so now with more opportunity and to play football in higher class facilities, there's been a significant boost in the Montserrat football squad.
Right.
So can you guess the highest rated club that represents the Montserrat national team? So do you know what I mean? So what player is the best Montserratian, and what's the tier he plays at in the English pyramid?
Okay. So I have no idea, because it's a very small country.
Yeah, there's not many people.
Because like the person I instantly think of is George Weah. Weah, is that
Weah, George Weah, yes.
Weah from Liberia.
Yeah.
Who's one of the greatest footballers of the century.
Yeah.
But nowhere near Liberia. So I don't know. I'm going to guess. I would be very surprised if we're talking about the fourth tier.
Okay, so actually, the championship, the second
really?
Tier.
Really?
Yeah, someone called Lyle Taylor plays for Birmingham City.
And they're quite a big club as well.
Yeah, it's not a small club.
They're not
no.
messing about.
No, and he's not. I think he's a striker, and he's played I think he scored a few seasons ago. He scores like 7 or 8 goals a season. Okay. Impact sub,
right?
But yeah, Lyle Taylor for Birmingham City.
In the UK, was he?
He was born in the UK, yes. Right. But because his family is Montserratian, who live in the UK, he is Montserratian. Mm-hmm. So he plays for Montserrat. But there are other representatives. There's Lewis Dubree for Shrewsbury, who are in the third tier. And there's a handful in the fifth and sixth tier. So you've got someone called Jamie Allen for Halifax Town and Junaid Mead for Dartford in the sixth tier. So there is a smattering. Yeah. It's not bad.
Yeah.
Sixth tier of football is a competitive, and you have to be decent to play for these teams.
And like 12,000 people, that's the size of my parents' local town.
Yeah.
Like Warminster, if that means anyone to anything. It's a tiny little town in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. So the quality of players in that small like population.
Not bad.
It's incredible. But we need to remember, like, the population of Montserrat now is about 5,000 or 4,000 people. But new generations of Montserratis living as an expat abroad is growing as a result of that, who can then say they are from Montserrat, even though they don't live there. But now link back to the actual squad, the improved quality of footballers and the reformation, and it's important, the reformation of the CONCACAF Nations League. Do you know what CONCACAF is?
CONCACAF is, is that Central America and Southern America?
So it's Central America and the Caribbean Islands,
right?
Essentially. Okay. So they have their own, like we have the Euros and then there's a Copa America and so on. That's their one. But they used to only do it once every 4 years. So that meant that teams like Montserrat would only play like two or three times every 4 years. But now with a Nations League, they play much more regularly. So they get more playing time.
Yeah.
And they get better as a squad. But they've done really well recently. So they're called the Emerald Boys, by the way. The Emerald Boys.
The Emerald Boys.
Yeah, that's the name of the monster, nickname of the team. So they started from ranked 211th, which was the bottom in 2002. And today, in 2022, they are 178th.
Oh, wow.
And they've beaten teams such as Belize, Aruba, Dominican Republic, and the Cayman Islands. They've even drawn games with like El Salvador. And they're known for like having an okay football team. Like,
what? Haven't El Salvador been in the World... No, Honduras has been in the World Cup.
They've played against Honduras and lost narrowly 2-1.
Hey, well, that's not bad.
It's not bad, is it?
Yeah, like Honduras were in the World Cup in, what, 2010, I think?
Yeah, exactly.
That's not bad.
So they've really had a real growth and a big strength to their squad, which is great for them.
Yeah.
So the other find on the Emerald Boys Growth Report is what makes this tiny Caribbean island special.
So, my number time this week is 3.2.
Right.
And the clue is, of course, with the rest of mine today, the brain.
3.2.
Yeah.
And the brain.
Yeah.
It's not like how many average brains are there.
There are no.
per person in the world.
No. One each.
3.2 and the brain.
Yep.
Is it, for example, actually how many... how many brain cells we lose every second or something?
That's an interesting idea. No, it's not, but I'm sure it'd be more than that.
Probably.
No, it's not. I'll give you a second clue. It's 3.2 centimeters, and that is the diameter of a hole.
Ah, the diameter. Is it now the biggest injury that's like a spear or something that's gone through the brain?
That's exactly right.
Oh, really?
Yes, that is exactly right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, a 3.2 centimeter wide spear went through a man's brain and he survived, which is the important bit. If he hadn't survived, then whatever.
Right.
What is that, war? So we are in the Appalachian Mountains up in Vermont in 1848, and a man named Phineas Gage.
Good name.
Very good name. For an American at this point in time, you need to be called something like Phineas Gage. Ulysses Grant, Phineas Gage, excellent.
Yeah.
And his job is to blow up the mountainside in order to lay the track for a railway line that's going to come through. So you can't make the railway line go up over the top of the mountain. It's got to go through the mountain. So he's there blowing it up. And what that means is you've got to dig a hole into the mountain. You've got to put gunpowder, I mean, slightly different from gunpowder, but for all intents and purposes, it's gunpowder down into the hole and then a fuse. Then rocks and pack it all with sand. And the idea behind the rocks and the sand is that when you blow up the gunpowder, if you don't have the rocks and sand, then the force of the blast will just go straight up and it's wasted.
Yep.
But with the gunpowder, it will go down into the rock.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And in order to push the rocks and the sand down, you use something called a tamping rod, which is just a big metal pole.
Right.
3.2 centimeters wide and about a meter long. And so Gage is tamping down the rocks into the hole, which has gunpowder at the bottom of it and a fuse at the bottom of it, when somebody calls him and he looks over his right shoulder and he opens his mouth to shout back, when he drops his tamping rod and the sparks from the rocks and the rod cause the fuse to ignite, then the gunpowder immediately explodes, sending this tamping iron straight through his head.
Oh my God.
And it enters the left side of Gage's face and it goes in behind the jaw and the cheekbone. And because he's got his mouth open, it means that it bypasses anything big and important in the bottom part of his face. It goes in behind his left eye, straight up into the brain, and rips out the top of his skull. And the force is so great that his skull is simply sheared in two.
Oh my.
He's got a forehead and the rest of his skull hinges back.
Oh.
But the force is so great that not only does it hinge back, but the rod passes through his skull too quickly for it to cause any skin to rip. So his skull kind of hinges out and then straight back. And he's fine.
Oh my. Oh.
The skull doesn't rip apart.
Just goes back together.
It just goes straight back together. Yeah. It's only held together by skin. So it's kind of like a baby's head that's very soft and pliable.
Yeah.
In that one particular part.
He's now got a malleable cranium.
Exactly. The rod lands about 25 meters away, covered in blood and brain, and Gage is thrown onto his back. And his arms and his legs start to shake because he suffered a massive brain trauma, and so the nerves are all firing weirdly. But he's not dead. And within a few minutes, he sits up and he starts talking.
What?
And he's able to walk over to a cart that then takes him off to the nearest town to the doctor. So he's got this huge hole in the middle of his skull, right the way through his brain, but he's still up and he's still walking.
What? How can you possibly survive? So I'm assuming because the blast was so quick, it's just shot through as thin as it could possibly be, considering, like, if it was a lot slower, it would just blow everything apart.
Yeah. Yeah, or it would get caught on the brain or on the skull, or it would start to ricochet or get stuck in his head. But because there's so much force, it just rips straight through, clean through the brain, essentially. But he's still missing a chunk of his brain.
Yeah, that's important.
And he gets to the doctor and he waits about half an hour for the doctor to turn up, which is typical NHS.
Right, yeah. So, what's happened to you? I've got a hole in my head and there's a part of my brain missing. Okay, well, there's someone next to me who's been waiting a lot longer, who's ripped their toenail off their foot. We'll see to her first.
Yeah, but, well, actually, what he says, he genuinely says one of the greatest understatements ever, which is he just points to his head and says, "Doctor, I've got some business for you."
I like how vague that is.
And the doctor says, he's a guy called Edward Williams. Dr. Williams says, "During the time I was examining the wound, Mr. Gage was relating the manner in which he was injured to bystanders." He was just chatting to people.
What?
Oh, yeah, there's a tamping iron straight through the skull while he's prodding around in his brain. He would get up and vomit occasionally, but the effort at vomiting... I will pause here just to remind you, cornflakes down, people.
Okay.
The effort of vomiting pressed about half a teacup full of brain through the opening in his skull, which then fell upon the floor.
So he's losing bits of brain when he vomits.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But he survives. And he survives the initial injury. And he survives long enough for another doctor to appear, who's a doctor called Dr. John Martin Harlow, who's an expert in abscesses in the brain.
Okay.
And so that means he's in the right hands. And his convalescence is difficult. He's not out of the woods straight away because he's got a hole in his brain.
Oh, yeah.
And couple of days he's fine, but then the next day he'll start getting very angry, very agitated, very violent, then incoherent, and then fine again. But the problem is by day 12, because he doesn't have a skull, he's just got an open wound, rot starts to set in. And Dr. John Martin has to start removing what he calls infected tissue and fungus from the brain in order to save Gage's life. But he does. And he says that the stench coming off Gage's brain and mouth are disgusting.
Oh,
because
God.
He's rotting from the brain.
That's incredible. Good doctor, though.
Good doctor, but not quite good enough, because Gage falls into a coma and they call the local carpenter, who measures Gage's body and builds a coffin and has it brought over to the doctor. And Harlow starts getting to work on this comatose patient, and he removes about half a pint of infected blood from the opening. And after about a week of the coma, Gage is still alive and he's starting to regain consciousness.
Oh, okay.
So they manage to clean the wound sufficiently that he looks like he will recover in some way. He should never walk again. He should never talk again. He should be dead by all rights.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he's opening his eyes. By about 3 or 4 weeks later, he's beginning to sit up again in bed. By 50 days after the injury, he can start to walk. And he gets up from the bed and he walks down the stairs of the doctor's office and he starts heading out into the town square and sitting and talking to people. And after 10 weeks after the injury, he was well enough to go home to his parents' farm.
What?
And by a few years after the injury, he was able to get a stable job again.
You're joking.
He works for a bit in a freak show in.
Yeah, of course.
It's called P.T. Barnum's American Museum, and P.T. Barnum's the great circus impresario of the 19th century, a horrific person.
Right.
And he was a living exhibit, essentially. He sat in the museum all day long with his big spike, telling people, yep, that went whoop, straight through there. Not demonstrating.
No, do it again. That would be...
admittance for him was, do you think he cost more or less than Mike the Headless Chicken?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to go with more.
Yeah, it was more. It was €5 this time.
€5, yeah.
It's an utter bargain.
Well, exactly. This guy with a spear through the head is an utter premium. You know.
But he decides he's had enough of the US, so he heads all the way down to Chile, where he drives stagecoaches between Valparaiso and Santiago for about 7 years.
Wow.
So through the middle of the Andes, driving these big stagecoaches, 6-horse stagecoaches, so they're massive. But he starts to fall ill, unfortunately, and by the late 1850s, he's suffering from really severe epilepsy.
Right.
And he dies in San Francisco in 1860 of an epileptic fit. But that means he survives 12 years with a huge chunk of his brain missing.
That is really impressive. What I thought you were going to say when he went to the doctors, I thought you were going to say, doctor, I have a headache.
But what he's used for quite often is studies in the relationship between the brain and personality, because his personality did seem to shift a little bit.
Oh, really?
But the weird thing about the brain is, well, there are many weird things about the brain, as we already know, but one of them is, just because you're missing a chunk of your brain doesn't mean that you can't function fully as a human being. And I was reading about a study done on monks and nuns in the US, where they would study their lifestyle before they died, and then after they died, they'd inspect their brains. And after they died, many, many monks and nuns showed signs of the physical signs of Alzheimer's or neurological degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't correlate with personality disorders or with cognitive functioning. So you could have an Alzheimer-like brain, but not show any symptoms whilst you're alive of Alzheimer's. And the reason why is because the monks and nuns who kept their minds busy with things like puzzles or reading or Sudoku or crosswords managed to adapt their brain in such a way that the parts of the brain that were dying would have their function taken over by the parts of the brain that were healthy.
And that's how
Phineas Gage's brain could keep working. Yeah, he's missing a chunk of the brain, but the rest of the brain will compensate.
Yeah, so it adapts to its trauma.
Yeah, it does. It completely adapts to it, and it rebuilds.
I was about to say, the brain is mental. It literally is. It totally is.
Yeah, so Sudoku and crosswords for life is.
It seems to be that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so for my number time, we're going to go with the number 300 and Costa Rica.
Okay, 300 Costa Rica. It's not the number of Costa Ricans that were just behind the 300 at Sparta.
No, it's not.
With their maracas and mankinis out having a lovely time.
It isn't that, but that would probably be the right amount necessary for that.
Yeah.
No, it's not that, but my extra clue for this one, I think you might need one for this.
I think so.
Is energy.
Okay. 300 and Costa Rica and energy. What do I know about Costa Rica? South of Nicaragua, north of Panama, quite a developed tourism sector.
Should give you an extra clue.
Yes, please.
It is something to do, it's a length of time.
Okay. Right. Okay. I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Go for it.
Does Costa Rica produce enough energy to meet its internal needs within 300 minutes of the new year?
Oh, that's a really...
That's my guess.
...wacky way of... That's really cool. It's not that, but it's on the right tracks of something like that. So, before I actually tell you the 300, I want to tell you that more than 99% of the energy in Costa Rica in 2019 was generated from renewable sources. So 99% of them. As a result of that, Costa Rica had 300 consecutive days on renewable energy alone in 2017, beating their own record of 299 days in 2015.
Right, so they're just showing off at this point.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Uh-huh. But these are the kings of renewable energy.
Uh-huh.
And you know, you mentioned that they're developing tourism industry. Mm. They're kind of one of these countries which is secretly developing into as we would say in geography, an MEDC, a more economically developed country.
Right.
I think that's quite a leap, actually. Mm. There has some problems, of course, but actually as a Central American nation, it's probably one of the, if not the most developed equally, not just through economy, but through society and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of really interesting stuff in Costa Rica. Now, I want to talk about how this 300 days, consecutive days of renewable energy was to come about. So you need to imagine this. So in 2017, Costa Rica had long periods of heavy rainfall, which was unseasonable at the time, and it swelled the 14 major rivers. The Arenal, the Rincon de la Vieja, the Paios, Irazu, and Turalba.
He's speaking Spanish.
I'm
again,
not
people.
Speaking Spanish.
He's not
very
having
well
a stroke,
here.
Don't worry.
It's okay. He's sorry, anyone Spanish. That speaks Spanish. They're all active volcanoes.
Right.
Amongst 200 volcanic formations across the country. Northwest Costa Rica in the
Here we go.
The Guanacaste Mountains has annual average wind speed of 12 meters per second.
Ooh.
So all this in 2017.
Yeah.
Is a great melting pot for renewable energy. You've got your dams, your hydroelectric powers in your rivers.
Yep.
And you've got all the volcanoes and the tectonic activity for geothermal energy. And you've also got mountainous regions where you can put wind turbines. 67% of their energy comes from hydroelectric power. 17% comes from wind, 13% from geothermal. And surprisingly, biomass and solar energy only contribute 2%.
Okay. Solar energy, you would certainly expect to be a lot more.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? And I get really angry that people in Scotland have solar energy. I think it's ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
Just because, what's the point?
That is optimistic.
Yeah,
at best.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the wish is further than the thought, isn't
yeah,
it? When
absolutely.
You put a solar panel was up in Aberdeenshire. But the a couple of extra things as well. Costa Rica are doing pretty well also with their water. 100% of all households in Costa Rica have access to clean water.
That's,
which is great, isn't
you
it?
You literally can't do any better than that.
No, you can't
well
do any
done,
better
Costa
than
Costa Rica.
Yeah, they're doing great. Even so much so that they have a surplus of energy and it can be sold throughout the... via the Costa Rica... Rican Electricity Institute,
okay.
Which has been abbreviated as ICE.
ICE.
Which I like. That began sending energy to the Central American regional electricity mark in 2015. So that includes Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, Honduras, and El Salvador. And so by 2019, Costa Rica earned about $180 million in sales of surplus energy.
Oh, wow.
Which is great, isn't
that
it?
Is
what
great.
A great economy that is.
That is.
And considering you were actually looking after your own people and then have enough to move on to sell, to support your own people even further.
Yeah.
Such a great system.
All well and good until they get invaded for being too renewable.
Yes.
For not buying enough oil.
That would be
kind of what happens in Central America.
And the problem they have extra is they're one of the very few countries without a military.
Yeah. That's very true. Just waltz in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to take all your energy. I'm going to take your windmill if you don't buy any coal from us. And there's nothing you can do
there's
about
nothing
it.
You can do about it. Yeah, no. It's the United Fruit Company all over again.
It is. Now, the last little thing here is there's a phrase in Spanish, and they use in Costa Rica called Pura Vida, which it means simple life or pure life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of what the Costa Ricans are trying to build towards.
Okay.
So
in terms
nice.
Of how today's episode's gone then, we've had
yes.
completely opposite vibes because you've
yes.
been 100% chill. Grapefruit, mangoes, rainforest, renewable energies. I've been blasting heads apart left, right and centre.
There's been we are the today literal antipodes of facts and discussions.
Yeah.
Even, you've made my globalisation, the rise of nationalism part seem very tame.
Yeah.
So that's me all done, Will, for this episode. I'm facted out. Oh, we said that before, haven't we?
We have said that before, and we got in some trouble for saying that before.
We did. They said we should never say it again, and I've just done it. But thank you very much for listening. You can find us on our YouTube, which is Gaps in Knowledge Podcast, and you can find us on Twitter, which is @GapsPodcast.
And you can email us gapsinknowledge@outlook.com, and we're also on Facebook, just search for Gaps in Knowledge Podcast.
So thanks for listening to the podcast. If you liked it, you can tell a friend. We much appreciate it. And that was the natural break for Will to come in, but I think
he's
too tired.
It was a natural break for me to come in, but it is late after a working day, so my brains have also been blown out through a 3.2 centimeter hole in my head. Yeah, thanks so much for listening, and as Reece said, tell a friend. And we will see you in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, see you then.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.